There was never a definition which had the word racism in it.
Well, I think the definition of Islamophobia circulated by the all-party parliamentary group some years ago. Say it was a kind of the Islamophobia was a kind of anti-Muslim racism.
That's not an earlier version of mine, Trevor.
No, I understand that. Sorry.
The all-party parliamentary group definition undoubtedly had two things in it, which I think are very controversial. One is the use of the term Islamophobia. The difficulty with the use of the term Islamophobia is it means very different things to different people. Doubtless to many Muslims, it means anti-Muslim hatred. But to many people, it's also, given its literal English meaning, means an irrational fear of Islam. Well, we're entitled to have irrational fears of religions or rational fears of them. And I think it was seen as being leading to the closing down of debate on subjects which are perfectly legitimate. The second one is about racism. Now, there's absolutely no doubt that many Muslims are the subject of racism because of their race. But a religion is not a race. Islam is a universal religion. And I think the use of the word racism is unhelpful and indeed counterproductive, quite apart from the fact that it's attempting to apply a racism label to a religious group.
Former Attorney General Dominic Grieve, that's it from me today. See you tomorrow.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Trevor. Have a good afternoon. 2 o'clock now. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
And coming up over the next 2 hours, the biggest oil exporter in the world says there will be catastrophic consequences for markets if the fighting continues. We're going to talk to Charles Hecker, geopolitical risk analyst. We'll also discuss how the conflict has affected Iranian women in their struggle for equality. We'll look ahead to Times Radio's coverage of this year's boat race with the women's presidents of Oxford and Cambridge boat clubs. And our big guest after 3:30 is the BBC's Europe editor, Katia Adler, discussing her three-part documentary, Europe on the Edge.
Let's get the news at 2, Eliza Phillips.
Thanks, Jane. Good afternoon. The American Defence Secretary says today will be the most intense day yet of American strikes on Iran. The comments from Pete Hegseth come hours after President Trump suggested the war may be coming to an end. That led to oil prices falling and stock markets recouping their losses. General Dan Kane, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says the U.S. is making huge headways.
Our strikes mean we've made significant progress in reducing the number of missile and drone attacks out of Iran. Ballistic missile attacks continue to trend downward 90%, and one-way attack drones have decreased 83% since the beginning of the operation.
Well, the UK is preparing a second ship for deployment to the Mediterranean. RFA Lime Bay, currently in Gibraltar, is often used for humanitarian and disaster relief missions. More details from The Sun's defence editor, Jerome Starkey.
It's really being put on standby for two reasons. One is potentially to treat casualties from any conflict as it spreads across the Middle East, but also perhaps more likely to take part in a non-combatant evacuation operation. That's an evacuation of primarily British nationals, were a country, particularly Lebanon, I think, is the one that military planners are looking at, where the conflict has spiraled there.
The warship HMS Dragon is still being prepared for deployment to Cyprus in the next couple of days. Meanwhile, the leader of Reform UK, Nigel Farage, says the UK should stay out of the conflict.
We should never, ever, ever have said no to the Americans using the bases, particularly Diego Garcia. And interestingly, Mauritius have been very, very clear they would not have allowed that base to be used at all. So there are differing opinions as to whether we should physically join the attacks. I, as leader, am saying to you, if we can't even defend Cyprus, let's not get ourselves involved in another foreign war.
So to other news, former midwife Donna Oakenden is to chair another investigation into maternity services. The probe was ordered by Health Secretary Wes Streeting over repeated failures at Leeds Teaching Hospital's NHS Trust. A prisoner has been charged with the murder of Ian Huntley. The Sirm child killer died on Saturday. 43-year-old Anthony Russell will appear in court by video link tomorrow. Former footballer Joey Barton has been charged with wounding with intent. He's accused of attacking a man near a golf course on Merseyside on Sunday night. The victim said to be in a stable condition in hospital. And an Iranian footballer appeared to be forced onto a bus by teammates. It's as the national women's team prepared to fly out of Australia a day after five players escaped and were granted asylum. Video published online today shows the player being firmly escorted by a member of the squad and ushered from behind by another. One player was heard wailing as she said goodbye to a supporter. The women's team was branded traitors by Iranian conservatives when they didn't sing the national anthem at their opening match of the Asian Women's Cup. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
So that's who you're with this afternoon until 4 o'clock this afternoon. It's Fee Glover, this one, and it's Jane Garvey, that one. I'm identifying myself as the person who didn't sneeze into the microphone yesterday. It wasn't a sneeze, was it? It was a nose blow. And we have been threatened by our wonderful technical operator, Ryan, with a chance, I think, to hear that nose blow to music later on in the show. What's it come to? We're going to start with a look at what leaps and bounds are being made in the oil market at the moment. There does seem to be a different message every hour. It affects every single one of us, and we will talk about that with a risk analyst in just a couple of moments' time. After 3 o'clock on this programme as well, we're going to consider the fate of Iran's women. Now, we know that earlier protests led to horrendous treatment and death at the hands of the religious police. So what might the current conflict bring to over half the population now? Times Radio has the rights to broadcast the boat race that was announced last night. That will happen on April the 4th. We're going to talk to two of the presidents of the respective rowing clubs. And our joyful story today, and we do always look out for one at the moment, it comes in the shape of the monkey in a Japanese zoo who's had to seek refuge and find love with an IKEA cuddly toy after being rejected by his family. Well, things have come good for him. We don't know about the toy. The monkey, though, is definitely back in the family fold, so prepare to coo with delight at that one. I think that happens in just 15 minutes' time. All of the news ahead of Cheltenham with Vassos, and after 3.30, Jane.
We are talking to the BBC's Europe editor, Katia Adler. She's made a series for the iPlayer. It's called Europe on the Edge. She has been to France, to Germany, to Spain and to Italy. And she's taken the temperature. She talked to all sorts of people in all sorts of parts of those countries. And well, I suppose one of the topics we talk about, actually, because I've done the interview already, is who is now Europe's Trump whisperer? And it is really Giorgia Meloni. She is the one who seems to be as close to Trump as it's possible to be, although he's an inconsistent sort of fella, isn't he? So you're never entirely sure where you stand with him. But in those documentaries, Katia meets quite a lot of Italian people who do not like Americans at all. They are extremely mistrustful of the USA for a variety of reasons. So very entertaining programmes, these, and she takes us to some beautiful places. She's a big fan of Germany. And Germany is beautiful, but it's not really visited as a tourist destination these days. It used to be. The British loved their walking holidays in Germany, but it fell out of favour for understandable reasons. I think we all know why. But Katia is multilingual, highly, highly intelligent, and really interesting to talk to. So she's with us after 3.30.
So we've talked about this in the podcast as well, haven't we, about which of those countries that she visits we would quite happily make a home in, if we were asked to, and you would go to...
I'd just stay in Britain. But
you'd just stay in Britain. Okay.
But I think you could always make a case for Italian food,
yes,
couldn't you? Spain, a bit too hot for me. Germany, mountainous. France, the French.
Okay, so you are definitely in the right place.
Those are my issues.
Right, France, the French. Okay. Come in, any French listeners, defend yourself. I'd definitely head to France because you've got bread, empty roads, cheese, protests, rural bliss, old trees and romance.
Okay.
What's not to like?
Okay, well, if you have a view on this, where in the Europe would you live if not here in the UK, where it's actually rather a promising spring afternoon? 0333 003 2353 is the WhatsApp. We love hearing from you. Contact the programme this afternoon. We see everything you write. Yes,
even the rude stuff. Right, let Fee now bring us up to date with the most read stories on the Times website.
In at number three, does Trump really have a plan for what he's doing in Iran? Katie Balls writes about the US president continuing to contradict statements from his team, most recently on the length of the war in the Middle East. The second most read story, Iran latest, Secretary of War Hegseth says US is crushing the enemy. All the latest updates from the Times can be found there. That live page is constantly being updated. And the most read piece on the Times website, we spent £10,000 fleeing Dubai. The UK help has been appalling. Now, these are two Britons who escaped the fallout of the Iran war, saying that the repatriation process has been useless and they find themselves still thousands of miles from home. Now, the British-Iranian actor and comedian Omid Jalili told Times Radio Breakfast that the Iranian people want the war to continue until there is regime change. This despite President Trump suggesting that the conflict will end soon.
This job is not done until this regime go. It was always meant to be some kind of rescue mission. Right now, there are so many Western sections of society who are shouting us down. And I think this whole thing is that Iranians say, look, people say, can't you take everything in your own hands? And they say, yes, we did. We tried. We had an opportunity to have a protest. They killed 40,000 of us. We think that if there's no other solution, and if anyone dies, this is not on the people supposedly trying to liberate us, whatever their intentions are.
Omid Jalili, you can hear Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel every day, Monday through Thursday from 6 to 10 a.m. Every single ounce of news is carefully considered and weighed up, and then they talk about other stuff as well. Kate, this morning, was revealing what's in her prepping cupboard, because she has one too. She reckons she'll be able to survive, albeit not with her taste buds intact, for at least a week and a half. But the tragic news for those of us who are Stig Abel fans is he doesn't have a cupboard and he would barely get through a day.
Oh, well, I've got a bit of bottled water he could have. I want hard cash, though, Stig, if you don't mind.
I think water was the only thing that actually they do have quite a bit of in their house, but nothing else. Okay,
I think maybe we are trying to get ahead of ourselves, and we don't want to do that. We were trying to be soothing yesterday, which is why we had an item about cat behaviour. So let's try and just ease people's fears between now and 4 o'clock. I mean, after I've spoken to Charles Hecker about the oil situation, which is next.
Yes, we'll see how that goes,
we'll
Jane.
See how that goes, yeah. It's 0333 003 2353. So to the Middle East, and the Pentagon says today it will bring the most intense US strikes on Iran yet, despite suggestions from President Trump, yes, it is confusing, that the fighting will end soon.
Today will be yet again our most intense day of strikes inside Iran. The most fighters, the most bombers, the most strikes. Intelligence more refined and better than ever.
Pete Hegseth, he's the US Secretary of War. The biggest oil exporter in the world, Saudi Aramco, says there'll be catastrophic consequences for markets if the war continues. But the White House is dropping some sanctions on Russian oil to bring the prices down. Here's Donald Trump saying last night that he'd had a word with Vladimir Putin.
I had a very good call with President Putin. We had a lot of people on the line from our side, from his side. We were talking about Ukraine, which is just a never-ending fight. And there's tremendous hatred between President Putin and President Zelensky. They can't seem to get it together. But I think it was a positive call on that subject. And we obviously talked then about the Middle East. And he wants to be helpful. I said, you could be more helpful by getting the Ukraine-Russia war over with. That would be more helpful. But we had a very good talk.
Well, you know who that was. That was him talking about his conversation with Vladimir Putin. Charles Hecker is a geopolitical risk analyst and author of the book Zero Sum, which is about international business in Russia. Welcome, Charles. Thank you very much for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
First of all, the conversation between Putin and Trump. The war in Ukraine isn't any, it's less likely to end, isn't it? Because Russia's making loads more money now out of oil.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, the war in Iran largely has been nothing but a net positive for Russia. The price of oil has now spiked significantly, and that means that Russia's treasury once again will start to fill up. And that means it will be easier and faster for Russia to fund the war against Ukraine. What this does is it de-incentivizes any likelihood. It de-incentivizes Russia from returning to the bargaining table. Talks were in Geneva just a few weeks ago and were slated to continue. And right now, there's no reason for President Putin to engage in negotiations. Things for him now, financially and then militarily, are going quite well.
Yeah, but Donald Trump, in that clip we played, doesn't appear to, he doesn't make that connection at all, does he? He's just not willing to in public, or he doesn't see it. What is it?
Well, I don't think that he wants to openly admit that this is helpful to Russia. I think on some level, hopefully, he understands that this is what's happening, or at least somebody in the administration is telling him this. I think intuitively, everybody understands that higher oil prices benefit the Russian budget. And so I guess what this tells you is that the president is making decisions and setting priorities, and that the lower priority on that list is the war on Ukraine, and the higher one is the global energy market. And of course, the messaging to the American public, particularly in the fact, in light of the fact that we have an election in November. Yeah.
The midterms are coming, and the price of gas, as they call it in America, hugely significant to the MAGA base and indeed to everybody in America. So what does Trump do?
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, the price of gasoline at the pump in the United States is one of the U.S. consumers' most painful metrics. This is what hurts Americans in their wallets more than almost anything else, aside from, say, you know, the price of groceries or interest rates. And the Democrats are going to hammer Trump and the Republicans on affordability and the cost of living. And so every time the price of oil goes up at the barrel, the price of gasoline goes up at the pump. Americans are incredibly sensitive to this, and they will be made even more sensitive to this by the Democrats. So, you know, President Trump's number one priority is not to derail the elections for the Republicans in November.
But in that case, has this not been thought through? The attack on Iran was only ever going to cause exactly this situation.
That's right. It would be almost impossible to imagine that the White House, the State Department, the Treasury, the National Security Council, the Defense Department, it would be almost impossible to imagine that nobody in these organizations thought of or told the president to think about and anticipate a spike in energy prices. What the president has said publicly is that he understands that energy prices are rising, but it will be short-lived, and it's worth the trade-off for whatever his latest goal in Iran may be.
And that's the problem. We still don't really know what that goal is.
No, you're right. I mean, there's been very little clarity and very little consistency in the messaging coming out of Washington, not to mention that there are two parties really prosecuting this war. And so we're told this is to dismantle the Iranian regime. We're told that this is to dismantle their nuclear capability. We're told that this is because the president has the back of the Iranian public. And, you know, those messages sort of go on rotation as the war proceeds. And we're not quite sure which one is most important and what the impact will be of any of them.
But what we do know is that what the president said yesterday did bring the oil price down.
That's right. What the president did, I think quite deliberately, is he literally talked down the markets. He talked up the share price index, and he talked down the price of petrol, the price of oil, and the price of natural gas. Once the markets closed, however, yesterday evening in the United States, he began to talk again about ramping up the military effort. And just as we heard Pete Hegseth a moment ago say that, you know, as he says every day, that this is going to be the heaviest day of bombing, the war continues essentially as ever before.
Yeah, so yesterday the war was going to end. Today the war has intensified. Yeah. I mean, what are we supposed to think?
We're supposed to pay very, very careful attention to the news. And I think that a rational mind would assume that whatever the goal of the war in Iran may be on behalf of the United States, that it's not going to be achieved that quickly. Dismantling Iran's nuclear capacity, regime change, and liberation of an oppressed people, none of that is going to happen overnight. And it's not going to happen in the time frame that President Trump is forecasting. And I think one of the risks that we run in all of this is that President Trump does end the war and none of the goals, whatever they may be, have been achieved.
Well, Katie Balls, who's the Washington correspondent for The Times, has written a great piece that's online at the moment on thetimes.com. And she says, basically, nobody expects consistency from Donald Trump. He can say what he likes pretty much whenever he likes. And he sets his own rules. And if he says the war's over, then it's over.
Well, and basically it's down to the rest of us to sort of read between the lines or look at tea leaves. And right now, commodity markets and energy traders and the stock markets and the share indices around the world are doing their best to try to interpret a consistent message out of a rather typical Trumpian militarized word salad.
Yeah. The American administration, I think, has pointed to Venezuela and has suggested that oil production there has increased since the takeover of Delcy Rodriguez taking charge. Is that true?
The situation in Venezuela appears to be improving. And that is that, first of all, Delcy Rodriguez and what's left of the Maduro administration, which is everybody except Maduro himself, is cooperating with President Trump. The Venezuelan oil industry is in a fairly difficult state. I mean, the refineries, the transportation infrastructure, the ports have all suffered throughout the Maduro regime and won't return to perfect working condition anytime in the immediate future at all. And Venezuela, as much oil as it has, is not in a position to replace or substitute the blockage of Iranian oil that normally transits through the Strait of Hormuz. So while things may be going better in Venezuela, that doesn't take the pressure off global oil markets.
Okay. And the Strait of Hormuz, I mean, is it possible for shipping to get through the Strait right now?
Right now, no. The risks are still too high. It is almost impossible to get insurance. And when you do, it is prohibitively expensive. And we know that nobody is going to go through the Straits of Hormuz without insurance. The president has promised, potentially, a military escort to open up the Strait of Hormuz. He's suggested taking over the Strait of Hormuz. But until that very narrow choke point of water opens up, there will only be upward pressure on the price of oil.
Just briefly, if you can, Charles, are you surprised by all this? Or is this current situation something you might have anticipated?
It's very, very hard to be surprised anymore by what's coming out of the Oval Office. The amount of inconsistency, not just on Iran, but on geopolitics in general, on Ukraine, on India, on China, on spheres of influence. I think that, we had a rehearsal for this during Trump 1.0. Trump 2.0 is that world on steroids. And I think that one of the reasons why the world feels so dangerous, so disrupted, and so uncomfortable right now is that we can't count on the White House and the Oval Office anymore to give us a message that we can rely on.
Thank you very much, Charles, for your time. Charles is a geopolitical risk analyst, and you'll be interested in his book. It's called Zero Sum. It's about international business in Russia.
If you'd like to spend a little bit of time just considering somewhere else to live, we're definitely
taking those
thoughts this afternoon. It's 0333 003 2353. Sylvia says, where to live? Not France, not Germany, Yorkshire. From the Dales in the west to the seaside on the east, we are a proud nation. And David says, the French are fine. I travel in France a lot and meet with courtesy and friendliness. Please don't perpetuate lazy stereotypes. Dave is joining us from Southampton.
Yep. Right, okay. It was just a throwaway remark. And I hope to get a response, and I have.
Yes, you have. Yeah. I think more to follow as well.
Yes.
Coming up as well, what will happen to the stuffed orangutan from IKEA, now Punch the Baby Monkey has found acceptance in his troop? Now, I understand that sounds like I've sent out a coded message to people, because that is a word salad, isn't it? All of its own making. Unless you've been following Punch the Baby Monkey on the social media, you won't understand what's happened, but you will need
it explained to you. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The State of It USA is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times that brings you real truth about US politics and power. Join political heavyweights Katie Balls and Gerard Baker as they take a deep dive into the latest wrangles in the White House and bring you intelligent analysis and insight.
I went out on the road this week with the First Lady and we rode back in the motorcade.
No fake news, no flag waving and no Trump derangement syndrome. Just the inside track on the decisions that are shaping America. The State of It USA is available now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
Hello, Greg James here.
And I'm Seema Pankhania.
And we're the hosts of the Tesco Kitchen.
Every week, Greg and I invite a culinary powerhouse into the kitchen to cook a recipe that really means something to them.
Hold on to your hairnets, because this week we're joined by chef, musician and host of Big Zoo's Big Eats. You might have guessed it. It's Big Zoo.
Zoo is taking us on a trip down memory lane and showing us how to cook the lasagna that changed his life forever.
It's live right now on YouTube, so get involved.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Global events.
There's a warning that the impact of climate change is getting more severe and we're not prepared.
Breaking news.
Following allegations of potential fraud raised by the Times.
Reactive analysis.
What's going on in the government about discussion of extremism?
From the world's best journalists.
We're trying to look at some of the questions about migration and the implications for the economy, jobs and public services.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Transform your kitchen or bathroom. Wix has everything you need, plus all the finishing touches, from beautiful tiles and flooring to a wide choice in paint and lighting. Whatever you're planning, create the perfect space with Wix.
Well, it's always the way, isn't it? You heavily tease a story and then the guest isn't in the right place at the right time. So we are currently putting a tannoy announcement out across the whole of East Anglia for Professor Ben Garrod from the University of East Anglia to join us to tell us about primate behaviour.
Yeah, come on.
Come in, Ben.
Come on, Ben.
I have had a bit of support from Jean, who says, I'd like to live in Switzerland, actually. I spent 3 years working there in my 20s. I'd love to go back to live, but they don't want me because I haven't got enough money. I wouldn't want to live in France either because of the French, says Jean. Oh, Jean, now don't get me into any more trouble, but thank you for that. Someone else is going to put a positive. David, where to live in Europe? As it happens, I'm sitting in central France. As a permanent home, this is where I would choose. I have visited this region for more than 40 years, and the locals will always go the extra kilometre to help. The country I wouldn't want to live in is Wales. Wow. Wales.
Okay.
So I've always found people unfriendly. They're not unfriendly in Wales.
You have basically created a slightly nasty xenophobic opportunity for people to take aim at nationalities they don't like. And actually, that wasn't what we were hoping to achieve this afternoon. We wanted some lovely stories of where you would like to live
but
in
also,
Europe. But
also, I have found the people of Wales to be overwhelmingly very friendly. Indeed. So, David, I can't agree with you there. It's just worth saying that the Punch the Baby Monkey, if people don't know the story, it is a sad one, isn't it? It's a 7-month-old, what was the monkey, the type of monkey?
A macaque.
A macaque. And it had to make do with an IKEA cuddly toy because mum had rejected the monkey. And so he was given an IKEA Jungelskug soft toy. And that apparently...
Give us that again.
Jungelskog.
Excellent.
Spelt de Jungelskog, but I did have a little look earlier at the pronunciation, and it's Jungelskog. And it actually means, that's the Swedish, it means jungle forest, which is an odd name. But then all IKEA products have got strange names, haven't they?
So there have been some really lovely shots of Punch the Monkey curling up on the great big floppy orangutan toy and doing that thing that cats do, actually, you know, when they paw gently... which I think you would be doing with your mum in the primate world if things have worked out a bit better between you both. Ben can't join us today, but we are going to book him for tomorrow. So we will save all our further Punch the Monkey chat, and we've got a lot, for 24 hours' time. In the meantime, Iran has appointed a new supreme leader, Mojtaba Khamenei, a shadowy figure with a history of orchestrating brutal crackdowns on dissenters. And President Trump, we know, is not a fan. But what do we know about the new supreme leader, and what does his appointment mean for the conflict that is raging in the Middle East? Well, today's episode of the Story Podcast looks at that in depth. Daryl Morris has been talking to Times World Affairs editor Catherine Philp.
His name came up in the WikiLeaks some 8 years ago, in which it was said that he was a kind of shadowy but very powerful character who appeared to be running his father's office, but was not known to most Iranians.
What more do we know about him and his story?
Well, the first thing really he did in his life after his high school education was to join the Revolutionary Guard and to fight with them in the Iran-Iraq War. And he was really young when he did that. He can't have been more than 18 if you look at the dates. And that essentially gave him a security background that indeed his father never had. He later goes on to study at the Qom Seminary, which is obviously a religious education, but again, stops short of the kind of education that his father and other clerics have got, because he really only completed what I think we would recognise as a bachelor's degree in his religious studies. Now, since then, he's not been someone who's been very visible in Iran, but he has been working in his father's office. He's very aware of everything that his father has done in the past and has wanted to do. He specifically, I think this is interesting for, you know, what we're watching inside Iran right now. In 2009, when there were protests, anti-government rather than anti-regime, because they were carried out by reformist politicians who weren't trying to bring down the Islamic Republic, but who were strenuously objecting to what they saw as the fraudulent election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad as president. And so it was some of the candidates in that race who formed something called the Green Movement and brought a lot of people out onto the streets.
We want freedom!
This is a country which, according to the government, just overwhelmingly re-elected its president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. But in the capital, Tehran, thousands of protesters differed vehemently.
And Mojtaba himself jumped into that and took control of the Basij and the Revolutionary Guard, who were putting down those protests. The Basij are like a volunteer militia, very ideological. They work under the Revolutionary Guards, and they pretty brutally put down those protests. And most of those reformist politicians were either put in jail or under house arrest. And it really spelled the end of any mainstream opposition we've seen in Iran within the existing body politic. So I think that's quite a good illustration of how he would deal with any challenge to his rule from inside Iran.
That was Times World Affairs editor Catherine Philp talking to Daryl Morris. And you can hear more on the Story Podcast, one story told in depth each day. It is available for free wherever you listen to your podcasts. Plenty more, slightly more optimistic viewpoints of where you could go and live in Europe or where you've ended up in Europe. No, that's the wrong one. That's about floppy toys, isn't it?
We don't want that.
Let's bring in Simon. You've got Simon's? Simon says, thankfully, due to Brexit, my Hungarian wife and I relocated to rural Andalusia 4 years ago. No regrets. Cost of living minimal. Local people delightful. And we're very proud of Piero Sanchez for his stand against the current madness. Have a lovely day. That's such a nice sign-off, isn't it?
Mm. Interestingly, Katja Adler talks about the Spanish view of Donald Trump in the interview here after 3:30. It's interesting because the Spanish have taken a firm line on the war in the Middle East, and it's quite distinct from other European leaders. So anyway, Katya explains that after 3:30.
And just that quick one from Paul. My wife has an IKEA floppy cuddly elephant toy I bought her. She cuddles that more than me.
Oh dear, Paul, you couldn't have seen that one coming. Or maybe you did. We'll get a sneak peek in a couple of moments' time into this year's Oxford and Cambridge boat race with the women's presidents of both universities' clubs. You're listening to Fee and Jane here on Times Radio. Just gone 2:30. Let's get the headlines with Eliza Phillips.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thanks, Fee. Good afternoon. The US Defense Secretary says America is planning its most intense day of strikes on Iran. Earlier, President Trump had indicated US objectives in the country are pretty well complete, suggesting the war could end soon. Well, the UK is preparing to send a second ship to the Mediterranean. RFA Lime Bay, currently in Gibraltar, is often used for humanitarian and disaster relief missions. Well, the warship HMS Dragon is still being prepared for deployment to Cyprus in the next couple of days. The biggest oil exporter in the world, Saudi Aramco, says there'll be catastrophic consequences for markets if the war continues. The White House is dropping some sanctions on Russian oil to lower prices, with Trump saying last night he'd spoken to Vladimir Putin. Well, Charles Hecker is a geopolitical risk analyst and author of the book Zero Sum.
The war in Iran largely has been nothing but a net positive for Russia. The price of oil has now spiked significantly, and that means that Russia's treasury once again will start to fill up. And that means it will be easier and faster for Russia to fund the war against Ukraine. What this does is it de-incentivizes any likelihood. It de-incentivizes Russia from returning to the bargaining table.
Meanwhile, the Chancellor's warning petrol retailers against price gouging, saying the government will not tolerate it. Rachel Reeves has said she'll meet with retailers later in the week after the conflict in Iran saw a spike at UK pumps. And Donna Ogden is to chair an investigation into maternity services in Leeds. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, ordered the independent review into Leeds Teaching Hospital NHS Trust last year. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Hello, Greg James here.
And I'm Seema Pankhania.
And we're the hosts of The Tesco Kitchen.
Every week, Greg and I invite a culinary powerhouse into the kitchen to cook a recipe that really means something to them.
Hold on to your hairnets, because this week we're joined by chef, musician and host of Big Zoo's Big Eats. You might have guessed it, it's Big Zoo.
Zoo is taking us on a trip down memory lane and showing us how to cook the lasagna that changed his life forever.
It's live right now on YouTube, so get involved.
Elite athletes know performance isn't just about pushing harder, it's about smart recovery. That mindset sparked MyoMaster, founded by Lottie White and Harlequins rugby player Joe Gray, now a thriving recovery brand. As MyoMaster grew, Lottie knew their finances needed to perform at the same level as their products. That's why they chose Xero accounting software. MyoMaster uses Xero for making tax digital for VAT. They've seen how taking your finances digital strengthens a business. And from April 6th, making tax digital for income tax means many sole traders and landlords must keep digital records and submit quarterly updates. MyoMaster's advice? Don't see MTD as just compliance. See it as a performance upgrade. Xero brings MyoMaster's sales, payroll and VAT into one place, giving Lottie confidence in her compliance and the insight to plan her next moves. With Xero, you can change the way you see MTD. Search MTD Ready.
Wake up to a brighter breakfast. Times Radio Breakfast. 7 days a week from 6 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Let Wix install your new kitchen. Choose from a wide range of kitchens and add the option of installation to your order. For complete peace of mind, all installations include a 2-year workmanship guarantee. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
John Pienaar takes over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon. So by then, we might have heard something completely different come out of Washington. John, where will you start?
I'm going to start with what we last heard coming out of the mouth of President Trump. And he spoke about maybe this war in the Gulf ending very soon. And we've had today Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, talking about the US and Israel very heavily winning the thing. So it's possible. But of course, it is always, it has to be said, that when Donald Trump says a thing, you never know what he's going to say next, and it may be completely contradicted, even on the same sentence, never mind a day or so later. But I'm looking at that possibility and then talking about, well, what might, if that is what happens, an early end, where does that leave everything and everyone? Where does it leave the Middle East? Where does it leave Iran and the people of Iran? If this war ends very soon or soon, it doesn't offer very much for people in Iran who are hoping for some sort of relief from that oppressive regime. Maybe that's just no longer part of the equation. That seems to be so too. So I'm looking at it from the American side. And also, what are they thinking about this in Iran? And talking to someone who talks to friends and loved ones in Iran and trying to get that take of it all. And also, the Straits of Hormuz. It is effectively impassable to shipping. It's such a vital sea and trade route. What is it like if you are escorting a ship, a tanker, down the Straits of Hormuz? Donald Trump said yesterday that ships would go down there if they had the guts to do it, which sounds easy to say, but I'm going to try and talk to a Navy veteran who knows what it's like to escort a ship down the Straits of Hormuz under the risk of missile attack. And now we're talking about drones. How far is it possible to be anything like safe from that attack, from the Navy point of view, and many other things too?
Well, also, if the cargo is oil, then that is doubly terrifying, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Speaking as a complete, total layman, and I'll find this out from a Navy veteran. If you are a Navy ship from whatever Navy down the Straits alongside a tanker, you'll have your defences, I suppose, against drones and against missiles, and you could probably do a lot to stop attacks, but it only takes one or two, you'd think, to get through before a tanker is hauled and on fire. And in that case, maybe blocking the Straits of Hormuz to traffic, which has a massive effect on oil, energy, and many other things that go down the straits into the world economy. So a Navy point of view would be, I think, interesting.
So fun times again at 4. John Pienaar takes over from us. And thank you to Matt, who's WhatsApped this. I've got no doubt that the story of the Emperor's new clothes springs to mind for many people of my age. It's not the Emperor's madness that's really the problem, but the sycophants who indulge him and the people at large telling him how splendid he looks. It's funny you mention that, Matt. I often think about the Emperor's new clothes at the moment. Do you, Fee?
Well, I do. And there's that bystander syndrome, isn't it, that we've started to talk about quite a lot. And I just can't understand what the conversations would be. As our previous guest alluded to, you know, the idea that nobody of huge intelligence in the Pentagon, across Capitol Hill, in all of the various lobby groups and think tanks, hadn't said to Donald Trump the possibilities of this being long, chaotic, difficult and unpleasant for the American people are vast. Mm. I mean, that just wouldn't have happened, Jane.
They don't seem to have considered people trapped in various parts of the world either. And it's interesting, isn't it? We've had emails to our podcast Off Air with Jane and Fee this week from people who are flying to all sorts of places to get back to Britain via China. Just had a message here from Elizabeth Clare. I live in Switzerland. I've done for the last 20 years. I'm so glad to get back here on Friday last week after a prolonged stay in Dubai. It was so awful to leave my family behind, but I'm glad to be back with my children here in Switzerland. So obviously that's just one example of someone who's had a tough time getting out of Dubai and coming home. But I mean, did they not think about these people either? And I appreciate our correspondent is not the most unfortunate of the people involved in all this. It's just caused chaos, and they must, as you say, they must have known it would happen.
And also, I do not understand how we can be approaching the end of a conflict and be ahead of schedule with the end of that conflict if all that has happened, apart from a huge global chaos and loss of life, the result has been to replace one Ayatollah with another Ayatollah.
Well, you'll have your thoughts on this. 0333 00032353. You're listening to Times Radio. Much more, of course, from the war in the Middle East throughout the afternoon and evening here on Times Radio. Let's talk about the boat race, because for the first time ever, you'll be able to hear everything right here on Times Radio. If you tune in on the 4th of April, you can hear exclusive live coverage and commentary of both the women's and men's races. So this is a good opportunity to talk to the female presidents of both universities' boat clubs, from Cambridge, Gemma King, and from Oxford, Heidi Long. Gemma, Heidi, welcome. Heidi, can we start with you? How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Thank you for having us on today.
Well, it's a great pleasure. Now, Oxford, am I right in saying you've got it all to do? When did you last win the boat race?
We last won the boat race in 2016. So we've lost the last 8 boat races so far, which I'm sure it doesn't take anyone to realise that's not the type of winning streak you want to be on.
No, OK. I mean, obviously, you can't be responsible solely for what's happened. But why do you think you've had such a poor run?
I don't know. I mean, I think huge credit to a very strong Cambridge squad, and their leadership and athletes throughout have been exceptional. So it's not taking anything away from them. We've been through a bit of period instability with changing of coaches' roles, and your coaches, head coaches, and the leadership structure within a team makes a big difference. But we've had a bit more stability over the last 3 years with the same head coach and other coaches. So hopefully that will start to build a bit more momentum and learn a lot over the last few boat races that we can take into the one coming up next month.
Right. OK. And Gemma, are you confident that it'll be another triumph for you?
I really hope so. We've been doing everything we can to try and make sure that we can continue our streak. You can never sit back and just rely on your results from the past. That's the one way to not win a boat race. And so every year we're trying new things. We're trying to make sure that we're staying ahead, making sure we're as fast as possible, and ensuring that on the day we put down the best race possible.
Okay. Gemma, tell me about you're in the boat race, aren't you? You're taking part. What is your role exactly?
Yeah, so I'm the president of the women's squad this year, which means I have a much more leadership role, sort of day-to-day making sure everyone's in the right place, right time, attending lots of meetings and making sure that everything just runs smoothly in general, and being there as someone to speak to no matter what comes up in someone's phone.
Okay, I mean, will you be in the boat?
Yeah, well, you'll have to look out on Thursday where we've got crew announcements. So nothing is set until then, but hopefully on Thursday you'll find out who's in the boats.
Okay, Heidi, is it a very tense time then as people wait to see if they're going to take part?
Yeah, hugely tense. The selection is always a massive part of sport, and especially in rowing, you compete against your teammates to then compete with them in the same boat. So yeah, the last few months we've done a lot of testing on the rowing machines as well as on the water, and looking at crew fit, because not only do you need the fastest 8 people and cocks in a boat, you need people in the right seats to make the whole boat go quickly. So there are lots and lots of jigsaw pieces to put into place to get fast boats on the day. But we're getting really close to the final selection for the blue boat, Osiris, which is our reserve boat, the lightweight 8 as well, and then our spare boats too.
Yeah, and we shouldn't take any of this for granted, should we, Gemma? Because not so long ago, the women... Well, where did you race? Where was the female version of the boat race?
Yeah, so until 2015, the women raced in Henley, which is a much shorter course. So the boat race is 6.8 kilometres in London now, and before it was about 2 kilometres, which is obviously a very different race. And the men used to race in London, and thanks to all the hard work of our alumni and supporters and those who were around in 2015, the women's race moved to the Tideway and got the same coverage as the men's. And so we're really grateful to those that made that.
Yes, I'm sure, and it's really lovely to hear you expressing gratitude. I mean, Heidi, it shouldn't have taken so long, should it really?
I mean, we would have loved to have competed on the same stage as the men from the beginning, but to have that change 10 years ago means a lot. And yeah, echoing Gemma's comments, like, we are so grateful for all of the women and other supporters that came before us to enable this to be possible today, because yeah, we really are standing on the shoulder of the giants that have led the way for us.
Have you actually competed in the boat race before, Heidi?
Yeah, my first time was last year. So I raced in the 2025 boat race and I was the stroke seat for Oxford.
And what's it like? I mean, can you hear the crowd? I mean, there are loads of people down there.
The atmosphere and the whole week leading into it, let alone on the day itself, we have about 200,000 spectators or more along the banks of the Tideway from Putney to Chiswick. And it just is electric, like the film crews as well, helicopters, but just all of the public that come out to support the racing crews is phenomenal. And you can't quite beat the noise of when you step out of the boat bays, like with your crew smacking on the boat, and you walk down through all these people. Like, yeah, the noise really can like liven the soul and get you ready to go and racing.
Gosh, you've almost got me about to join a rowing club. But I may have peaked, Heidi, but it's very sweet of you. Gemma, what do you think about the impact of the crowd? What do they do to you?
Oh, they definitely make you feel like it's a big event you're doing. They really show how historic and important the race you're about to do is. I think when you're racing, you have to sort of shut it out and stay focused. But as you come to the start line, just taking it all in, I think it's really important. I think there's very few opportunities in your life that you will ever be sat in a boat with hundreds of thousands of people on the bank. And so really just making the most of that and just enjoying it.
And Gemma, we've been very positive about it all because I do think it's part of the fabric of our national life, isn't it, the boat race, really. But Gemma, to people who say, oh, it's just they just bring in ringers from America and it's not proper British students from Britain. What do you say?
I disagree. I think everyone who comes here has found their own path into it. We have people who have learnt at college. In fact, in the squad this year, we've got several people who came to Cambridge having never rowed before.
Really?
Learned here. So actually one of the girls who has been in the boat the last couple of years, she just learned at college. We've had people go on to the Olympics who've learned here at Cambridge. And whilst we do have international students, they've also learned at their universities and they just really want to study here as well. So yeah, there are people from all different internationalities, but I think that makes it more exciting. People want to come to Cambridge to study, but also the boat race is such a cool opportunity to do alongside that.
Do you worry at all about the water being dirty? Because it has caused illness before, hasn't it?
It's not something we think about too much. I know that work has been done to help clean it up. And at the end of the day, we're just there to race and do our best.
Well, I'm very impressed by you both and I really wish you both the best of luck. I think, to be honest, it's Oxford's turn, isn't it? I mean, let's just acknowledge that it's time they won. So, but doesn't mean they will. And it'll be well worth hearing on Times Radio. Have I bigged it up enough? What do you think?
Well, I think you have, but also you've shown a rather delicious optimism about the nature of sport. It's somebody's turn to win. They haven't had it for a long time. Now, be nice.
Probability isn't my special subject, but it seems high time. Thank you both. Best of luck to you. Gemma King of Cambridge and representing Oxford, Heidi Long, and they're competing in the boat race. You can hear it on Times Radio on the 4th of April.
Were you one of those nice parents who always let every single
not a nice parent, no.
kid at the party win something in Pass the Parcel? Oh, did you
did
notice
try.
When young Johnny hadn't had a go?
Yeah, I would be one of the people who would, would reach out to the child that hadn't, or was sitting next to the person who won Pass the Parcel. I mean, that's always, isn't that that's a terrible place to be, isn't it?
It very much
is. It does blight childhoods, that. It really does.
It's fourth on the podium, isn't it?
It's
not on the podium. Yeah. Fourth in the race. Right, coming up, are there any real benefits to fasting? That's what we're going to talk about in our health news. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow. All the latest national and international breaking news and informative interviews. Plus, hear unrivaled journalistic expertise and detailed analysis on the radio programme where sharp insight meets original thinking. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive. This afternoon from 4 on Times Radio with ServiceNow. The AI control tower for business reinvention. Find out more at servicenow.com.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, Greg James here.
And I'm Seema Pankhania.
And we're the hosts of The Tesco Kitchen.
Every week, Greg and I invite a culinary powerhouse into the kitchen to cook a recipe that really means something to them.
Hold on to your hairnets, because this week we're joined by chef, musician and host of Big Zoo's Big Eats. You might have guessed it. It's Big Zoo.
Zoo is taking us on a trip down memory lane and showing us how to cook the lasagna that changed his life forever.
It's live right now on YouTube, so get involved.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
What time do you have your last meal of the day? Are you partial to a chunk of cheese from the fridge before settling down for an ITV crime drama? Gosh, you're in my head. New research from the Northwestern University in Chicago has found that overnight fasting is key for your heart and metabolism. Let's talk about this with Dr. Rachel Ward, RGP and co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast. Rachel, fasting has just been in the ether so much of late. Would you recommend it as a doctor?
Good afternoon. Well, yes, I think there are some benefits to fasting. But what I would say about this as one method of controlling our eating is that there is a lot of evidence to show that actually the most effective thing is really looking as an individual what suits you, what suits your lifestyle, what is going to be realistic and what is going to stick. So interesting, there has been a recent Cochrane review. This is where it looks at all of the evidence out there for certain treatments, interventions, and they have found that intermittent fasting is no better at helping us to lose weight than other methods. But for some people, it can be absolutely fantastic. Now, if we're thinking about not specifically just losing weight, are there benefits? Well, if we think just kind of from a logical perspective, we know that when we eat, our insulin levels go up, and this causes glucose to be translated into glycogen and fats, and that's stored in our liver and around our body. But when we fast, our insulin levels go down and we start to use those stores. And so if we're just constantly eating, we have no episodes, you know, where we have a decent period of not eating. We never have that dip in insulin, and it doesn't let us use those stored foods. So it is really logical, of course, that we need to have times where we don't eat. There is some evidence that it can be beneficial for other things, but I think actually don't just focus on the fasting. Yes, you know, don't eat all evening until you go to bed. But also it's just so important that we keep looking at what we're eating as well as when we're eating it.
There's a very interesting piece by our fashion editor Anna Murphy in The Times today talking about a diet that she has found absolutely works for her. It's called the human being diet. She makes the point in the piece, Rachel, that women's bodies are very different to men's bodies. And actually there may be some harm that we cause ourselves as women in trying to fast in the same way as men. What's the physiological evidence about that?
I don't know if there's specific evidence to, you know, comparing women and men, but what I would say is yes, we are certainly different to men, but we are also all different as individuals. And I think she talks in the piece about the human being diet, and actually, when I read that, I thought, well, this kind of just sounds like controlled eating, of, you know, eating healthily where you have three meals with good gaps and no snacks in it. This doesn't sound particularly groundbreaking. And I think sometimes some of these diets are kind of couched as this new breakthrough way of eating. Actually, when you kind of, you know, take away the gloss from it, you look and I think what it does is it actually just puts people into some good habits of not overeating and eating good meals. Maybe I'm being completely cynical about that. But I think, yes, we are different as men and women. I don't know if fasting has any potential damage on us as women. But I think I keep coming back to that same thing, that we know what does us damage is eating bad food, eating junk food, eating highly processed food. And I think certainly the nutritional therapist that we have at our practice and that I do a lot of work with, that is always her main focus of really making what you eat good first, and then these other things can be what you can work on after.
Yeah, we're always looking for the kind of easier fix though, aren't we, and the more sparkling fix, because that is such good advice, but we just don't want to take it. Baroness Casey is leading the review into social care. It's such an important topic, this, Rachel. It's a problem that really is only going to get worse with an ageing population. And she suggested that the government assign a dementia SAR. Would you welcome this? And do you agree with her that there is something about the way the condition of dementia in all of its various forms is being treated that is actually really, really damaging?
Yeah, I mean, she said, rightly so, that the majority of people that develop dementia are older people, and that they do not have the same voice and they are not getting represented or invested in the way that they should. And she said, you know, the system is creaking, inconsistent and impenetrable. And I think that's very accurate description, if I'm honest, when we look at the social care system and how it is joined to healthcare and how it coordinates, it can be so disjointed and so difficult to navigate. So, yes, I think, you know, potentially appointing somebody who is going to oversee this and try and navigate the system and make it more joined up can only be a good thing. I think, unfortunately, You know, it always, in these things, it comes down to investment in funding. She made a brilliant description as well, that she said that the NHS has become the National Hospital Service rather than the National Health Service. Everything has been focused on hospital specialist care rather than the care for people like dementia patients that we need in the community, day-to-day, non-specialist care. And I think there has been a lot of discussion from Wes Streeting about trying to improve that, bringing care back into communities. At the minute, the kind of structure and funding is not really following that ambition, but it certainly makes sense. And I think everybody working in community, like myself, would certainly welcome that shift back into community care.
And finally, Rachel, taking your daily vitamin could actually slow down ageing. Now, do you buy into this? This is research which has looked at five measures of ageing hidden within our DNA. And the results do seem to suggest that people who've been taking multivitamins might be able to expect not a huge amount of longevity as a consequence, but certainly some.
Yeah, so an interesting trial. A couple of things to point out about it. It was funded by Mars Edge, which is part of the Mars Confectionery Group. And actually, some people in the trial were given cocoa extract. And they were looking to see if that had any benefit. And it was found that it didn't. But they did find that some people had some potentially beneficial changes in their DNA, that their DNA aging was different in the group of people that had multivitamins. However, what's interesting here is that even the people conducting this study have said that actually most of the things that, you know, that you get from a multivitamin can just be got in a good diet. And I keep coming back to this boring, repetitive message, I'm afraid, that actually what we should be aiming for is a balanced, good, nutritious diet. Now, of course, not everyone has that. And I think if you are somebody that struggles with appetite, struggles with access to good food, struggles with cost of good food, then yes, topping up your vitamins with a cheap multivitamin could definitely be beneficial. But wouldn't it be great to think that actually everyone has access to good food and doesn't need to supplement with medication ultimately?
Right. And I'd like to put in the caveat that at the end of the study, those who took the vitamin pills had a biological age that was on average 4 months younger than those who didn't take any supplements.
Well, yeah, worth
but the way the world's going at the moment, yeah. Just, you know, say goodbye to those 12 weeks. What's the point?
Oh, <no. laughs>
Rachel, it's always lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Well, it was going well until we were trying to be less bleak.
No, I know, but 4 months, Jane.
I know.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a lot, is it?
No. I mean, you do have to ask, is it worth the bother? Right, we're heading towards 3 o'clock. Let's just enjoy the wonderful music. Here we are.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, it's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here on Times Radio until 4 in the next hour. What has the war in the Middle East meant for the women of Iran and their struggle for liberation? We're going to talk to an Iranian women's activist. Mike Ashley, he's falling behind in the bid to take over one of the world's oldest football clubs, that's Sheffield Wednesday. Vassos Alexander has more on that. And our big interview after 3:30 is with the BBC's Europe editor, Katia Adler, talking about her new documentary, Europe on the Edge, in which she answers the question, who is Europe's leading Trump whisperer at the moment? Of course, it could change. Here's the news at 3, Eliza Phillips.
Thanks, Jane. Good afternoon. A senior Iranian official has warned Donald Trump to be careful not to get eliminated. Ali Larijani, Iran's National Security Council chief and top advisor to the slain supreme leader, was responding to Trump on X today. It comes after the US president gave mixed messages on when the war could end, with the US saying today will be the most intense day of strikes yet. At the Pentagon, the US Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth repeated Donald Trump's threat to bring death, fire and fury to Iran if it continues to block oil exports in the Strait of Hormuz.
He takes very seriously the condition of that straits. We have capabilities that no other nation on earth has, and we're certainly working with our energy partners across the administration to control for that. That's part of that scoping of this. The world needs to understand this doesn't have, this isn't intended to be, nor is it, something that will expand. We know exactly what we're attempting to achieve here, scoped properly, and the American people can count on that for sure.
Meanwhile, oil prices have fallen sharply after Donald Trump suggested the war with Iran could be over soon. Costs had rocketed as the conflict intensified. The UK is preparing for the impossible deployment of a second ship to the Mediterranean, with warship HMS Dragon yet to leave Portsmouth. Tory leader Kemi Badenoch dismissed suggestions she should apologise for claiming British forces are just hanging around in the Middle East.
I was criticising the government that they're not doing enough, and they are the ones hanging around. France has sent about 10 ships to the Mediterranean. What's our Prime Minister doing? And instead, what he's trying to do is use the soldiers as a human shield so that he's not being criticised. I think that's absolutely disgusting.
In other news, former midwife Donna Ockenden is to chair another investigation into maternity services. The probe was ordered by the Health Secretary Wes Streeting over repeated failures at Leeds Teaching Hospital NHS Trust. Ms Ockenden says it must be firmly focused on families who have waited far too long for answers.
If we were building a house, you know, we wouldn't put the roof on first. We'd put down strong foundations to make our building safe. And that is very similar with a maternity review. We need to get lots of agreements in place so that I can receive records, so that I can store data.
Well, she's also examining maternity failings in Nottingham. A prisoner has been charged with the murder of Ian Huntley. The Soham child killer died on Saturday. 43-year-old Anthony Russell will appear in court by video link tomorrow. Former footballer Joey Barton has been charged with wounding with intent. He's accused of attacking a man near a golf course on Merseyside on Sunday night. The victim is said to be in stable condition in hospital. And a wrongly convicted sub-postmaster has warned David Lammy there will be many more miscarriages of justice if he goes ahead with his plans to curb jury trials. Joe Hamilton has written to the Deputy PM, urging him to rethink the controversial change in the law that would replace jury trials in England and Wales with a single judge. It's in cases where the defendant is likely to face up to 3 years in jail. Well, MPs are due to vote on the bill later, which is aimed at tackling backlogs. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Thank you for all of your messages so far this afternoon. We will get to them in a couple of moments' time. We hope. We were particularly keen to hear from you ahead of the 3:30 interview as to which country in Europe you would like to alight upon and make your home, and why would you be doing that? We've turned away from just bashing the French. That's where the conversation ended up immediately. Yeah. And we're being a little bit more embracing, aren't
we? It is incredible how quickly it turned. And I know I started it.
You started. It wasn't quick at all.
All right. Okay. Well, I'm sorry.
I was defending the French. I think it's a magical country, and I'd like to be there as soon as possible. 0333 003 2353 is our number this afternoon. Rights groups are warning that the conflict in Iran is worsening conditions for women and civil society. The female-led protest that erupted across the country in 2022 following the death of Mahsa Amini after her arrest over hijab violations brought global attention to women's rights in the country. Now, civilian casualties are being reported across the region following US and military action from Israel as part of Operation Epic Fury, including a strike that hit a girls' primary school in Minab. Joining us to help us understand the situation on the ground is Susan Tamasebi. She is the Executive Director of Femina, an organisation that supports women's rights across the Swana region. Susan, a very good afternoon from us here in London. The treatment of women in Iran was a very significant and very pressing issue before this conflict began, but it's mentioned very little now. Why does that happen in so many conflicts?
Hi, thank you for including me in your broadcast today. And of course, I've been working to promote women's rights in Iran for many years, and women suffer from legal discrimination as well as cultural discrimination. And I should say that before the protests started on December 28th and following the Mahsajina Amini protests, actually, women had managed to gain a lot of rights, maybe not legal rights, but the rights that they managed to gain nevertheless, despite resistance from the state, including appearing in public as they wished to dress or participating in marathons and riding motorbikes. I mean, these were things that are technically illegal, but women were doing it. And now, you know, following the protests that started and the deadly crackdown of protests on January 8th and 9th that resulted in the killings of thousands and arrest of tens of thousands of people. And now the war, it seems that it's possible that some of those rights may be lost. Certainly there continues to be a lot of repression. But I think the humanitarian impact of this war is indiscriminate against Iranians of all walks, including women and children. And if it's okay, I'd like to talk a little bit about the humanitarian impact of this war and why it's especially significant with Iran, because, you know, we have no humanitarian structures in place. Usually when there's a conflict, the international community organizes and coordinates and mobilizes to support the civilians impacted by those wars. But because Iran has experienced sanctions and it's very isolated, there's no structures in place to provide this support. And of course, the Iranian government doesn't have, I think it's been criticized a lot for not having sirens or shelters for people who might have to take shelter during bombings. But these strikes by the U.S. and by Israel have been, as the U.S. and Israel have mentioned multiple times, extremely severe, and they have targeted indiscriminately civilian structures as well as military structures, although the aim, supposed claim of the U.S. and Israel is to target Iran's military structures. But according to reports, 19,000 civilian structures have been impacted. 16,000 of those are residential. And I should mention that in Iran, people work very hard, like anywhere in the world. They work very hard to become owners of an apartment. Sometimes it takes a lifetime before they can actually own an apartment. And it means that these families are all displaced. When we talk about 16,000 structures, usually because the targets have been mostly in cities, we're not talking about individual buildings. We're talking about apartment high rises. So with each one of these, you have multiple families that have been displaced and have lost their homes.
Sure.
And sometimes this is the only asset that the family has. Sometimes it's the only asset that a multi-generation of that family owns. And, you know, they're displaced. We have, you know, the numbers of the displaced are very difficult to track in Iran, because Iran is also, the Iranian government has shut down the internet. There's an internet blockade. So it's very difficult to track that. But Iran is also home to 1.6 million Afghan refugees who were already displaced, who are going to be displaced again because of, as a result of this war.
So we understand the chaos of the situation, and thank you for illuminating us more on that. But if I can just get your thoughts on a couple of key points from the last 10 days or so, Suzanne. When you first heard President Trump saying, now is the time for you, the Iranian people, to rise up, you know, to the America, I think his words were, American strength is behind you, but now is your time. Did you think, okay, well, that might be possible, given everything that you've told us about the infrastructure within the country? Was that ever a realistic thing for him to ask and expect?
Listen, we know the history of regime change taken up by the U.S. and its allies, and it's never been successful. So anyone who assumed that Israel or the U.S. is out to save the Iranian people assumed wrong. They were very naive to assume that. The President Trump doesn't care about the Iranian people, neither does Israel. This is an Israeli expansionist project. It's unfortunate that the Islamic Republic has created a situation to allow for this horrific and illegal war. I do blame also the Islamic Republic, but this is an illegal war under pretenses, multiple pretenses, none of which are legal and none of which are justified. Mm. It's part of an expansionist policy of Israel in the Middle East. And we've seen this happen in for over 2 years, what Israel has done with the support and the facilitation of the U.S. and other European countries in Gaza. And this we're seeing the same playbook in Iran, unfortunately. So I don't think Israel nor the U.S. cares a bit about any Iranians. Right. And they want to see Iran. And we see from the attacks and how they're targeting civilian infrastructures and how the bombing is indiscriminate and is destroying the country, we see that the intent is to create chaos and ruin and to destroy the country. Right. It has nothing to do even with the government or the Islamic Republic. I think that no matter who is governing Iran, this would be the playbooks. Just right. as in
well,
Syria,
I wanted to,
when we
yeah,
see
sure.
that a Syrian,
Suzanne, can
that
I just ask
that
another
a Syrian
question?
Government is in power now.
Can I just ask you another question? Because we don't have unlimited time on the programme and we're interested in your thoughts. But Suzanne, without any external intervention, do you believe it would have been possible for the Iranian people to have changed that regime themselves?
Well, it's unfortunate that the Islamic Republic is so bloody and decided to kill peaceful protesters. But I also think that the claims from outside contributed to people coming into the streets and also contributed to some degree to the violence used. This is not in any way to justify the violence, the incredible, horrific violence that the Islamic Republic used against its own citizens. But it contributed to that because the protests prior were for 10 days, they were largely peaceful protests, right? And at the minute that everybody called on Iranians to go and take over different buildings and how they were going to retaliate against Islamic Republic if they used violence was when the Islamic Republic used unprecedented, unbelievable violence against its own citizens, which is condemned and totally unjustified. But I think it's important to look at the different aspects of, you know, different elements that led to this violence as
sure.
well. It's not at all to justify it by any means. But I do think that, you know, the geopolitics played a role in this. And certainly, I think maybe many Iranians inside the country, they were so angry, rightfully angry at their own government that they wanted strikes. But I don't think anyone expected these level of strikes. Those of us who have watched the U.S. take on multiple campaigns of total destruction in the region, starting from Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, you know, the continued bombings of Yemen, Syria, all of those. We know that there's no positive intent in any of these military campaigns, whether it's by Israel or by Iran, I mean by Israel well, or by the U.S. or their allies.
Is there any justification or positive element of the campaign in simply seeking to not have leading Iran any kind of regime that would have been prepared to use a nuclear weapon within the region?
Every single security establishment has claimed that there would be no regime change through military strikes. And certainly those of us who've worked in civil society, who have a history of working in civil society, do not see our salvation from a fascist regime at the hands of another fascist regime or through military intervention. There is no liberation to be brought through death. There's no liberation to be brought through death. And I don't even understand how this could even be a question. It can't and shouldn't even be a question. But looking at the history of regime change efforts, it should never be a question. Certainly the UK was part of the Iraq invasion that happened, that put so many people, that, you know, that killed so many people. Look at what happened in Libya. Look at the entire region. And all of this region had authoritarian governments.
Mm. Well, nobody, I mean, our Prime Minister,
Our Prime Minister
would say that the position of the UK at the moment is to look at international law and to look at the lessons from history and to look at previous campaigns and to stand apart from the military offensive that has taken place.
I'm afraid that's the case, we only have a couple of their illegal war against Iran should be condemned. Why is that not condemned? Has the UK condemned that?
I wanted to ask you, according to international law, as our final question to you, Suzanne.
So the UK, you're speaking on behalf of your Prime Minister. Has your Prime Minister?
No, I'm not speaking on behalf of my Prime Minister at all. So I'm just trying to put to you the point say, that right? he has made to the wider world. Suzanne, I'm so sorry, but we are out of time. We will have to leave it there. I hope that you feel you had an opportunity over the last 14 minutes or so to tell us how you feel, and we can hear the passion about your home country in your voice and in your arguments. Thank you very much indeed. That's Suzanne Tomasebi, who's Executive Director of Feminar. It's an organisation that promotes women's rights.
It's almost 18 minutes past three, and next, Vassos Alexander here to talk us through what might be in store for long-suffering Sheffield Wednesday. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
There really is an awful lot of news going on. We'll bring you all the latest from the conflict in the Middle East, and the Peter Mandelson files are likely to be produced by the government. We'll look ahead to that.
And our panel is Edwina Curry and Giles Corran to go through the biggest stories of the day.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel. Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
My dad is more than just a dad. My dad provides life-changing support to those affected by disaster and conflict, helping people in crisis, whoever and wherever they are. Through the gift that he left in his will to the British Red Cross, my dad still makes a difference to the world, even though he's no longer with us. You can make a difference too. Please go online and search Red Cross Wills and consider leaving a gift in your will to the British Red Cross.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Here's the sportsman. It is only Vassos Alexander. An American businessman looks to have overtaken Mike Ashley in the battle to take charge of Sheffield Wednesday. David Storch's bid is seen as more likely to succeed than the sports direct boss and former owner of Newcastle United, where Mr. Ashley wasn't all that popular, was he?
He really wasn't.
No. OK, so let's focus on David Storch, who appears to be the man who might take over at Sheffield Wednesday. Who is he?
So he is an American businessman. He worked for 39 years in an aviation company, and then in the last sort of 8 years, he and his son have formed an investment firm in the US. He is apparently very taken with owning an English football club. He's been apparently sniffing around Plymouth and Blackpool and Reading, but he went to a Sheffield Wednesday match earlier this season against, I think, Norwich, and he said he was blown away by the... I mean, if you're blown away by the atmosphere at Sheffield Wednesday this season, then you really do love Sheffield Wednesday, because they're not having a great season.
In fact, they've had a pretty terrible time, haven't they?
Well, so they're still on minus 7 points, and it's what, mid-March, so they're near the end of the season. Of all the things to happen, you know, they were relegated at the ground of their big rivals Sheffield United a couple of weeks ago, so they're definitely a League One team next season. So look, this all comes down to the former owner. this Thai guy called Dave Fonchansiri. His 10 years in charge ended in October when he put the club into administration. They were docked the 18 points it is in total, basically because they weren't paying staff on time last season. In October, he finally said, yes, I'm off. Mm-hmm. And so the club's in administration. We did think that a former professional poker player was the guy who was going to take over and own Sheffield Wednesday. I think that's what the administrator said on Christmas Eve. But then he pulled out last month saying, I know I've overvalued the club at about £48 million. Now, the trouble is, £30 million quid is needed just to pay off the debts. And if they can't pay off the debts, then they start next season on minus 15 points in League One. I was talking to a Sheffield Wednesday fan earlier this season, and he said, look, the thing is, you look at, you know, the tales of even Brighton, but Bury and Macclesfield Town, Maidstone United, these clubs that have gone out of business. And you think, well, surely the fans could do something to stop this. Why would they just sleepwalking into this? But then he said, but what were they meant to do? What are we meant to do? You know, and
well, they could just got to find millions of quid, haven't they?
Yeah,
it's simple.
Unfortunately, for the fans, it's just bad news after bad news.
OK, it is one of the football names, though, isn't it, Sheffield Wednesday?
Absolutely.
Sleeping giant and all that.
Of course. I mean, until very recently, you know, Premier League club, the FA Cup semi-finals used to be played at Hillsborough, one of the grand grounds, but that obviously needs hugely updating now. No investment has gone into that ground for decades now. So the new owner, whether it's David Storch or somebody else or Mike Ashley, will have to... I think the figure in the Times article this afternoon was £100 million is needed to pay off the debts and get the club back on a sort of even keel. But, I mean, Sheffield Wednesday, it's like when Sunderland were in League One. So Sunderland are not a League One side. Sheffield Wednesday are not a League One side. They're one of the most historic clubs in the land, in the world, and, you know, should absolutely be Championship or Premier League.
Yeah, OK, so we'll keep an eye on that. But a hard time to be a fan, although sometimes I think some fans rather like all this.
Well, they do say... I remember, you know, I'm a Fulham fan, and there was a few seasons ago...
You've had ups and
downs. Yeah, we have. Up, down. And then a few seasons ago, the last time we were promoted to the Premier League, we won the Championship by miles, scored all the goals in the world. And I was talking to Richard Osman, another Fulham fan, and we agreed that the best season is winning the Championship every year. If only you didn't have to go into the Premier League where the sort of...
Get
clobbered. But just winning the Championship easily would be lovely.
You dropped a name there, didn't you? But we let it go. Did you hear that, Fee?
I don't know who this man is.
No. A celebrity pal, Richard Osman.
Yes, of what talent does he have?
I mean, he's written a few books.
Has he?
Yeah, he's presented a few shows on the television.
No, it's not keying in with me. Is it keying in with you, Jane?
No, but I gather he's a football fan and a fan of Fulham. So
just don't sit behind him if you're at Fulham, because he's very tall.
Oh, we know that. We have interviewed him, haven't we? But not in the flesh.
Yeah, but only on Zoom.
Yeah.
Only on Zoom.
Which I think is wise, because he and I together wouldn't be the same height.
Do you know what, we don't want that publicity shot, because it's just there for comedy value, isn't it? Who is standing either side of him?
Who is the very tall person that we did stand up? Who was that?
Penny Lancaster.
Penny Lancaster, yeah. Yeah, that was funny. Very tall person, I thought.
My kids said that we looked like hobbits. Which is very unkind.
Penny was great, though. That was at the Cheltenham Literature Festival, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Are you going to do a segue link?
This is good. This is why she's paid the big bucks.
Oh, no, don't tell her. She thinks we're paid the same, Vassos. Right.
We are paid the same.
Now, you've got the latest for us from the Cheltenham Festival.
Cheltenham Festival updates on Times Radio with Ladbrokes. We bring daily free bets for Cheltenham. That's Laddisfaction. 18 plus, gambleaware.org.
Not to be confused, I should have said, with the Cheltenham Literature Festival, which is an entirely different event.
It is.
But much enjoyed by all who go, as I know darn well. The Cheltenham Festival is enjoyed by attendees too.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the highlight of the jump racing calendar. I mean, I have covered a few Cheltenham festivals now, and they're the roar when the first race is off is just, it's one of the great sounds in sport. People absolutely love the Cheltenham Festival. It is absolutely the highlight. Rob Wright, the racing editor of the Times newspaper, had three predictions for day one today. And first, in the first race of the day, the Supreme Novices Hurdle, he picked Old Park Star to win, and Old Park Star has won.
Well, what odds?
At 5-2. Oh. A British 1-2-3. There's a big rivalry at Cheltenham between British-trained horses and Irish-trained horses, and over recent years it's been Ireland, 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 Ireland. But good start for the British horses this year. A Lossy Mouth in the Champion Hurdle at 4 o'clock, and Down Mexico Way in the 4:40 are his other picks, if you want to lump it on. and JP McManus, the famous horse owner and Ryanair person, and you know him. Yes. It's his 75th birthday, and he's just had a winner in the Juvenile Hurdle with Saratoga, so he's celebrating.
So he's won because it's his birthday.
I don't know if it's because it's his birthday, but it's you know, it is his birthday, and he's had a winner, so lovely. There is a lovely, my son was working behind a bar at the Cheltenham Festival last year, trying to earn money to save up for his first car. And in order to save money on accommodation, he was camping in the snow. He's absolutely thrilled that 12 months on, when he's not working behind a bar and camping, it's absolutely beautiful weather.
I do always genuinely think of this as the start of the sporting, not quite summer, but there's definitely a hint of spring, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, when Cheltenham starts. You know, Cheltenham comes around, and then suddenly we have, you know, cup finals, the League Cup final, and, you know, then you're April, and then you really are sort of starting to sort of gird your loins to a sporting summer.
Yeah. When did you last go to the Cheltenham Festival?
Well, probably about a decade ago. We went with Virgin Radio about 5 years ago, I would say.
And?
Well, there's a special train that goes right, that not at Cheltenham Station, Cheltenham Racecourse Station. There's a steam train that you can take, and we were guests of Victoria. I'm going to drop
name. Just go for it.
We were guests of Victoria Pendleton, and we chugged in a steam train with, like, you know, full champagne and canapes and stuff into the actual festival itself. It was great fun.
Well, she's got power then, hasn't she? Yeah.
Richard Osman hasn't got that.
Right. Well, that's some nice memories. Have you been to the Cheltenham Festival?
I did go once, but it would be a very long time ago. And I didn't go courtesy of anybody special. I just went as punter. And I don't think we went on the steam train. So, no, I've got no valid anecdotes here at all, have I? I was an attendee. And I wouldn't have won any money either, because I would always remember if I had.
Yeah. No, I've only been once, and it was rather alcohol-fueled. I'm not very proud of it, but there we go. Some years ago. Vassos, thank you very much. That was Vassos Alexander, it says here. He'll be with us every day at around this time. And if you want more on that story, you can go to thetimes.com and head to the sports section. Here's that Cheltenham reminder.
Cheltenham Festival Update on Times Radio with Ladbrokes. We bring daily free bets for Cheltenham. That's Laddie's Faction. 18+, gambleaware.org.
Thank you very much. And we were asking earlier, because we are about to talk, you're about to hear, Katja Adler, who is the BBC Europe editor. And she's been making some documentaries, Vassos, about Europe on the Edge is the title of her documentary series. Mm-hmm. And she's been to Germany and Italy and France and Spain. And we have been asking our listeners where they'd like to live in Europe. Nobody so far has mentioned Greece, but I suspect if that were
you could
a question
do a lot
you,
worse. Well, you could do a lot worse than live in Greece, honestly.
Make the case for Greece.
I tell you what, they're going to put that on a tourist board T-shirt.
I actually do some work once for the Greek tourist board.
Oh, my God. You need to write. Excel. You're the king of the anecdote. Carry on.
the thing about living in Greece, I mean, obviously there's a language barrier and an alphabet barrier for many.
Yeah.
But that just the welcoming kind of, you only want your sort of your fellow Greek to be happy. You know, there's that sort of there's that real kind of it's a hug. Living in Greece is like a hug. Plus, it's really nice weather. Plus, there's loads of wonderful ancient monuments. Plus, there's the sea. And I would probably say it's Greece or Italy if it was going to be one country's food for the rest of my life.
Yes, I get that. Mm. I think I'm with you. Yeah.
A couple more from the listeners. Anne says, Sardinia, please, just because it's Sardinia, heaven on earth in these hellish times. And John from East Kilbride, there are many beautiful European countries with wonderful people that would be glorious to live in, were it not for the politicians in charge, and that applies to most of our home countries. That leaves Scandinavian countries by a process of elimination.
Thank you. More thoughts on where you'd live in Europe if you didn't live in the UK, please. 0333 003 2353. Make a case, make a passionate case for the European nation of your choice. Vassos, we'll see you tomorrow. Thank you very much.
More name dropping this time tomorrow.
Yeah, well, no, don't knock it.
Feel free. We love it.
Yeah. What's coming next?
Katia Adler, the BBC's Europe editor, on her three-part documentary, Europe on the Edge. It'll happen after the latest news headlines with Eliza Phillips.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thanks, Lee. Good afternoon. The US Defence Secretary says America is planning its most intense day of strikes on Iran. Earlier, President Trump had indicated US objectives in the country are pretty well complete, suggesting the war could end soon. Well, the UK is preparing to send a second ship to the Mediterranean. RFA Lime Bay, currently in Gibraltar, is often used for humanitarian and disaster relief missions. The warship HMS Dragon is still being prepared for deployment to Cyprus in the next couple of days. The biggest oil exporter in the world, Saudi Aramco, says there'll be catastrophic consequences for markets if the war continues. The White House is dropping some sanctions on Russian oil to lower prices, with Trump saying last night he'd spoken to Vladimir Putin. Well, Charles Hecker is a geopolitical risk analyst and author of the book Zero Sum.
The war in Iran largely has been nothing but a net positive for Russia. The price of oil has now spiked significantly, and that means that Russia's treasury once again will start to fill up. And that means it will be easier and faster for Russia to fund the war against Ukraine. What this does is it de-incentivizes any likelihood. It de-incentivizes Russia from returning to the bargaining table.
Meanwhile, the Chancellor's warned petrol retailers against price gouging, saying the government will not tolerate it. Rachel Reeves has said she'll meet with retailers later in the week after the conflict in Iran saw a spike at UK pumps. And Donna Ockenden is to chair an investigation into maternity services in Leeds. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, ordered the independent review into Leeds Teaching Hospital's NHS Trust last year. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Donations to British Heart Foundation fund scientific research that can help save lives. People like Joe, who's pitching his next big business plan. Maria, who's sending out her wedding invitations, and Jack, who's just being a teenager again. Because when you donate, you fund more than just science. You help save lives. British Heart Foundation funds research that aims to cure inherited heart muscle diseases. But our work is not done. Donate now at bhf.org.uk and keep us beating.
Get a first look at tomorrow morning's front pages. Tonight from 10 with Carol Walker on Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. There's over 80 stunning styles to choose from and great offers too, including the Spend and Save with up to 50% off kitchen units. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
Thank you for all your thoughts this afternoon, and keep them coming. 0333 003 2353. Let's go to our guest this Tuesday, and it's Katia Adler, who is the BBC's Europe editor. She's done that job now for 12 years, and she's got a three-part documentary, a new series called Europe on the Edge, on the iPlayer now. Now, in these programmes, she asks, what is Europe to do while war rages in the Middle East and Russia becomes increasingly aggressive? And who deals best with the current resident of the White House? Here's the trailer.
Europe, rich in history and culture.
Absolutely beautiful.
For centuries, this continent has played a central role on the world stage.
Look at that.
But this is Europe's most perilous moment since the Second World War.
This is the bunker.
It faces an aggressive Russia, an ambitious China.
It's quite shocking to hear you say that it is much closer right now to Beijing than it is to Washington.
Yeah. And Europe's most powerful ally can no longer be fully relied on.
I said, if you're not going to pay your bills, we're not going to defend you.
I'm Katia Adler, and after years of living and working in Italy, France, Spain and Germany, I've got to know them really well. So how are these four countries, with mainland Europe's biggest economies, responding to this turbulent new world?
There are a lot of police vans behind us.
What strengthens them?
Oh, wow. It looks like a shark.
And what weakens them?
The trailer for Katja Adler's new iPlayer series, it's called Europe on the Edge. Well, I've been talking to Katja and she explained exactly what the programme is all about. She visits during these shows Italy, France, Spain and Germany.
So it's what I call the big four next door, right, Jen? Because at the moment, whether it was previous Conservative Prime Minister since Brexit or now with Sir Keir Starmer, they're saying that in the world that we live in, which is extremely unpredictable at the moment, we need to work better together with our European neighbours, particularly when it comes to security and defence, but in all sorts of areas of mutual interest. And so this is a look at the big four next door. So it's France, Germany, Italy, Spain, the biggest economies on mainland Europe. You know, if we need to work better together, if we want to rely on them more, it makes sense to know them better, to understand their strengths and their weaknesses, where we can rely on them or not. But I think also it's important to say, you know, we live in quite scary times, and I think the news agenda can feel really overwhelming. And obviously, we put together this series before the US and Israeli attacks on Iran, but the intention even then was to do this with a light touch. So, you know, these are countries that we think we know, but this is really getting under the skin, but also with a bit of joy in there as well. So not all doom.
No, far from it. And thank goodness there is some joy and beauty, which is really important to emphasise. There's some wonderful scenery in these programmes. Can we just briefly, and we should explain, we're talking on Monday, which of the major European powers is closest to Trump as we speak? Has Giorgia Meloni assumed the role of Europe's chief Trump whisperer, would you say?
Well, there are a number vying for that role, aren't there? I mean, the Prime Minister thought he had the role. Giorgia Meloni, definitely, she's among very few European leaders to have a truly warm relationship with Donald Trump. She was also very close to Elon Musk as well. You've obviously got Viktor Orban in Hungary. I think amongst those four, definitely Italy with the closest relationship. And I think, you know, while we're looking at things going on in Iran, you can see that Friedrich Merz, though, the German chancellor, is also vying to have sort of a seat close to Donald Trump. And I think when we talk now about European powers needing to work better together, Iran is a really good example, Jane, of where this often stumbles, because at the end of the day, it's each country for themselves, and sometimes each government or each politician for themselves, where they act in what they think is their best interest. And I think if you have a look at Germany and Spain when it comes to Iran, that, you know, you really see this in sharp relief. So Friedrich Merz was straight out there after the initial attacks on Iran, the Israeli and American attacks, saying, you know, there's no point criticizing our allies at times like this, and there's little use really in looking at international law. Whereas Spain's Prime Minister, Sanchez, said this is definitely outside international law, and he was extremely outspoken. When Donald Trump last week hit back at Spain and said he wanted to slap a massive trade embargo at Spain to punish it for what it was saying about the attacks on Iran, and also the fact that Spain said that the US could not use military bases in Spain to launch attacks on Iran from, who was sitting next to Donald Trump? It was Friedrich Merz of Germany. And did he say anything to support his European ally? He said not a word. Now, you can have a look at why Friedrich Merz might have done that. He wants to be close to Donald Trump. He's looking at his spluttering economy, like all major economies in Europe. The German economy, once the powerhouse, is now really, you know, really struggling. Those exports that Germany relies on are very energy hungry. We're looking at cars. We're looking at the chemical industry. And since Germany has lost access to cheap Russian energy because of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine and the sanctions, it now relies for 96% of its access to liquefied natural gas, LNG, on the United States. And the United States is Germany's second largest trade partner. So you can see why Friedrich Merz might have kept silent, but it does not do very much for an image of European unity that Europe says is important.
So I completely appreciate what you're saying about Germany. Why do the Spanish feel free, if you like, to take their stance then?
So Spain relies less on the United States for trade, and Pedro Sanchez at home is extremely unpopular. He rises in opinion polls when he stands up against Donald Trump, which he's done on a number of occasions. He was very outspoken over the war in Gaza, but particularly with Donald Trump. When Donald Trump, and of course he's not the first US president to do so, pressed European allies, insisted that they spend more on their own defence, and that was signed off at a NATO summit last summer. The only country to say no was Spain, and that played very well at home. Also, I mean, and these things can be true at the same time, there may be cynical political reasons why Spain's taking this stance, but also Pedro Sanchez believes in this. He believes that the attacks on Iran right now were outside of international law. He does believe, he says, in an international rule-based order, which he thinks is being eroded. Those two things can be true at the same time.
Right. And interestingly, in the first of these documentaries you've made, you're in Italy, and you've pointed out that Meloni personally has a good relationship with Donald Trump. But I was really interested in the part of the documentary that showed that the Italian public, quite a chunk, really mistrust the USA, don't they? And they've never really liked American influence very much.
They've been very US skeptic. And I think what's interesting to know, what I show in the documentary, is there is a section in Italy that's very sympathetic to the Russian narrative as well, which is something quite separate. You may not know that during the Cold War, for example, Italy's Communist Party was the biggest in Western Europe. And there was a very long time, a lot of skepticism about NATO. And also, I think what I show in the documentary is that Italians just don't trust the state. They don't trust the government as a force. And this goes back centuries in Italy. It's still quite a young country. And in the years, the hundreds of years before it became independent in the 1860s, Italy was permanently, well, the country that is now Italy, parts of it were permanently being conquered by one power over another. And so Italians learned to trust the very, very few. So when it comes to the war in Ukraine, for example, straight after that full-scale invasion of Ukraine, we've now marked the four-year anniversary of that just now, Italy stood out as the only Western country where the majority of Italians didn't want to send weapons to help Ukraine. And now, 4 years later, it's only 15% of Italians that want anyone in Europe or the United States to send weapons to Ukraine. Not because they don't care about Ukrainians, they say, but because they don't trust their state, their government, to protect them from any knock-on effects, whether it's rising energy prices or any kind of reprisals from Russia. So that's really what this series is about. It's just understanding where attitudes come from.
Right. I mean, it really is. It's a fascinating glimpse. And Germany is a country that, I'm afraid it's still true, isn't it, that in this country we associate Germany with only one thing. And actually, it's a country that Britain or British visitors used to flock to because it is beautiful. There's so much to see there and so much to do. But I was really, really startled by how, the crumbling infrastructure that you show, those broken bridges. Germany appears to be falling apart.
I think Germany's been going through a sort of an identity crisis that is symbolised in those crumbling bridges. There's thousands of them that have been sort of closed down because they need repairs. The whole German system that it got so famous for, Germany being so efficient and German economy roaring on behalf of all of Europe, really is how it was traditionally seen. But it relied very much on the outside world. So it relied on selling to China, selling to the United States, having its security guaranteed by the United States, and running on cheap energy from Russia. And each one of those things it can no longer rely on. That's caused a crisis in its industry and its economy. And what was then revealed was actually there was a whole load of crumbling infrastructure. I mean, also, you know, it has this shiny, efficient image, Germany, but I can't get over every time I go there how, you know, people still use faxes in Germany. Never mind the fact that your mobile phone often can't get reception there. And then there's the state of the road. So under Angela Merkel, for example, who was prime minister for 16 years, there was so little internal investment in Germany. It was not a country that invested in its own infrastructure. And that's really come home to roost. Also, when you want to help Ukraine, Jane, because if you think about it, if you want to use traditional armory, and there has been, especially at the beginning of the war, you know, bigger reliance on tanks and, you know, sort of traditional machinery, you have to be able to move that across Europe. And Germany is a big artery there. But if its roads and its bridges aren't up to the task, I mean, you know, this says something about the country itself. So now you have a government that says, right, we are now going to invest big time in our defense and in our infrastructure. And by 2029, NATO says that Germany wants to spend more on its defense than France and the United Kingdom put together. It wants to build the biggest conventional army. I think it's interesting, as you say, Germany, often people only think of one thing, and I think you're referring to the Second World War there. But 80 years after that, the fact that Germany wants to build the biggest conventional army, and now that it's so rooted in the EU and so rooted in NATO, actually that's looked at with relief by its European allies and neighbours rather than with apprehension.
And what about Brexit? I mean, does anybody care? Does anybody mention us? What do they think of the UK?
So it's not that people don't care. They care, and Europeans would still rather we were in than out. But the rancour, the bitterness, you know, everything that I covered as Europe editor during the negotiations, it's just evaporated. The idea of us joining, or the conversation thought of us joining, rejoining, is something you only hear of here in the UK. It's not something that's discussed in European circles. What they do is they look at us now with a lot of warmth, a lot of respect. I think Russia's full-scale invasion 4 years ago made a massive effect. The fact that the UK took a leading role, the fact that the UK wants to work together more when it comes to energy security, when it comes to more conventional security, that is absolutely welcomed. And because we live in this very unpredictable world, I mean, right now the Middle East is burning, but Europe faces this, you know, Russia, which is, you know, it's an aggressive Russia that wants to expand. You know, the common understanding across Europe is if Russia isn't stopped in Ukraine, it will look to spread its influence further into Europe as it wants to redress the security balance after the Cold War. We've got an economically aggressive China, and we have an increasingly unpredictable best friend abroad, the United States. And so, you know, Europe is contending with all of that. So it makes sense that the powers in Europe want to work together. And what the EU is realizing more and more is that it is absolutely impossible on the world stage to get 27 countries all agreeing when it comes to foreign policy or even security and defense. So we're seeing more and more kind of ad hoc groups of, you know, coalitions of the willing, if you like. I mean, there is the labelled coalition of the willing on Ukraine, of course, which is led by the UK and France. Then there's smaller groupings like the UK and Norway when it comes to wanting to track, you know, Russian subs. And then you have the Baltic states, the Nordic states with Canada, which is almost becoming a glorified European country, looking at safeguarding their parts of the world. And they feel that they share common values, and more cooperation with so-called like-minded allies, Japan, South Korea, Australia. So you're seeing much more of a mix of different groupings when it comes to self-interest. So these are really interesting as well as threatening times. But as I say, with this documentary, we try not to clobber anyone over the head of it. This is a softer glide through the big four next door and just understanding a little bit where we can rely on them more and sometimes less.
Katia, I know you are based in Brussels. If you had to pick another of these European locations as your base, which one would you go for in terms of prosperity, a sense of happiness, a sense of optimism?
Oh, Jane, that's really, really, really hard. That's like putting lots of really good cakes in front of me and asking me to choose and what I would normally do. And I feel we might be sisters in this. I would ask for one spoon, multiple plates, and take a bit out of each one. And that is how I feel about these countries and, you know, others in Europe. I really feel this is an incredible continent, you know, whether it comes to natural beauty, food, culture, history, but also the fact that we do, I mean, you know, we live in very cynical times, and but things are never black and white. Basically, European countries tend to share certain values about humanity and the rules that we would like to live by. And I believe that still exists today. And I think, again, that's why Europe on the Edge sounds hard, but what we do is nothing against them, but we don't talk to politicians and we don't talk to journalists either. This is about the humanity of Europe and understanding the humans who live next door. And I think it's really important in these times that we don't lose our humanity or our trust in humans wherever they live in the world, you know, and however they are touched by these events, without wanting to sound too moralising. Well, that sounds a bit dreadful, doesn't it?
I'm going to write down that your answer to that question was Spain. OK, thank you. Katia Adler, who is the BBC's Europe editor, and she's brilliant, isn't she? And Lisa says, I'm a huge fan of Katia Adler, really enjoyed her previous series, and episode one of this one didn't disappoint. Thank you for that, Lisa. And it's just worth saying, as Katia did at the end there, there are no politicians in these programmes, no journalists. It's, do you know that it's that vanishing species?
Is it real people?
It's real people.
Oh my goodness.
Real people across the continent of Europe.
What a find.
I know. Incredible. We're all inside. If you're a real person, please consider yourself somebody worth interviewing, because we'd love to meet you. We really would. So it's available on the iPlayer now. You will find it. It is called Europe on the Edge. Now, coming up, I regret to say we've got some breaking news about transport strikes. Well, there we are. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Hugo Rifkin on Times Radio with Elevon. Join Hugo every Monday to Thursday morning from 10 as he takes a sometimes serious and sometimes satirical look at the day's news, politics and culture, covering all the major stories making the headlines with in-depth analysis and exclusive interviews. Hugo Rifkin on Times Radio with Elevon. We support all payments for your business. Make one decision today. Visit elevon.co.uk.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Hello, Greg James here.
And I'm Seema Pankania.
And we're the hosts of the Tesco Kitchen.
Every week, Greg and I invite a culinary powerhouse into the kitchen to cook a recipe that really means something to them.
Hold on to your hairnets, because this week we're joined by chef, musician and host of Big Zoo's Big Eats. You might have guessed it. It's Big Zoo.
Zoo is taking us on a trip down memory lane and showing us how to cook the lasagna that changed his life forever.
It's live right now on YouTube, so get involved.
Crayola has landed on Planet Happy Meal, so explore your little astronaut's imagination and see where their creativity takes them. From colouring to creating, the sky's the limit. So reach for the stars. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until 23rd of March from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, whilst Crayola range comprises toys only, while stocks last.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Thank you very much. You're back. What's the matter, Fee?
Nothing's the matter at all.
Okay,
well, what's the matter with you? Are we about to have a row? It's only Tuesday. You just saved those for Thursday.
Well, Wednesday. Let's go through the breaking news, actually. We have, as we've made clear, that we're trying to sort of just elevate the mood just slightly, because it's not easy at the moment. And I think a lot of people wake up every morning and they grope for their phone. I know I do. And then we just think, what now, don't we? It's definitely one of those moods across, frankly, across the world at the moment. And this won't cheer people up in London. London Underground drivers are to stage a series of 24-hour strikes in the next couple of months in a dispute over hours. This announcement just in from the RMT. Walkouts will be held at the end of March and in the second half of April and May. Let's go to the PA, the Press Association's industrial correspondent, Alan Jones. I feel we've been here before, Alan. What's happened now?
Yeah, we definitely have been here before. And what's happened now is that the RMT union has just announced 6 24-hour strikes. First one starting a week today, sorry, 2 weeks today, and then following on the following week in March, 2 in April and 2 in May. And it's over working hours. The unions say that the company is pressing ahead with changes to the working week, kind of compressing the hours into a four-day working week without agreement from the union. In a nutshell, that's it.
OK. Remind me, when were the last strikes? Was it last summer?
Yes, it was last summer. The last summer was amazing. You know, but so many people were on strike in the run up to the to the general election. Tube drivers were among them. Train drivers on the overground were among them as well. There hasn't actually been a strike on the underground for a while. There used to be a time when there was a strike, you know, virtually every month, but things have kind of settled down a bit over the last kind of year or so. But obviously they're flaring up again, and working hours, you know, this isn't one about pay. This is over working hours. It's a big issue for unions. You know, a lot of unions trying to get a shorter working week without any loss of pay. But what the company wanted to do here is obviously not what the union wants. There was a referendum, RMT members voted against it,
right.
And because of that they've announced these series of six strikes.
Now I'm reading here that members of the RMT have been instructed not to use any company issued electronic devices, including iPads, from the 21st of March until further notice. What's the problem here?
Yeah, I was trying to find out, to be honest. I've never known that before, whether that means they won't be able to ring each other if there's a problem, or check up on, you know, engineering works or something. It's a new tactic, and I guess it'll have some impact if they can't be contacted on you know, by phone or iPad. I guess it's one of those things we'll actually have to wait and see. There is another union representing train drivers on the tube, ASLEF. They're not involved in these strikes, so unless they suddenly announce a strike soon, there won't be a total shutdown of services on these strike days, but there will be, you know, complete chaos. I mean, so many people travel on the tube now.
Yeah.
It's incredible, really. So, you know, there's 1,800 members of the union involved in this. So, yeah, it's going to have a serious impact.
Yes, I mean, it will mean that people like me will have to reacquaint ourselves with the overground facilities and become incredibly grumpy in the process, because it just adds additional stress to the working day, doesn't it? But in the past, Alan, I mean, these strikes are threatened and then they're called off at the last minute. Could this happen again?
Oh, yeah, many strikes are called and are called off at the last minute. It's entirely possible they'll be called off. You know, there's a while to go before the first strike, so there'll almost certainly be some kind of meeting between the RMT and London Underground, and there's always a chance that the strikes will be called off. Yes, that happens a lot, but, you know, I think I'd be prepared to start making some alternative arrangements if I was commuting regularly by tube anymore.
Okay, you've marked my card. And the role of the mayor, Sadiq Khan, he always slightly rises above this sort of thing, doesn't he? Doesn't really get involved, or am I wrong?
No, he tries not to get involved, really. I mean, as I say, things have been fairly smooth. He has a generally quite a good, I think, relationship with trade unions. You know, he's a Labour mayor. There's been a lot of things happening for workers in London. So I'm sure there will be calls from opposition parties for him to get involved. But, you know, in the past, he hasn't kind of waded in and signed a check when there's been a pay dispute. So I'd be surprised if he does anything too publicly. He might well make kind of soundings behind the scenes, as it were, to at least try and get the two sides together, because, you know, that's what's going to happen. It's a working hours dispute. It's not a pay dispute.
Yeah.
So it's only going to be resolved between the union and London Underground sitting down and sorting out between themselves.
Thank you very much, Alan. Appreciate it. Alan Jones, the Press Association's industrial correspondent.
Now, I'm just about to dive into a studio to do a pre-record with tomorrow afternoon's guest, who is Eric Schlosser. He is the author of Fast Food Nation. It has been reprinted. It was a book that first came out 25 years ago, in which he detailed the dark side of the all-American meal. So he's updated the book with some thoughts about what's going on in the world of fast food at the moment. We have got plenty, plenty to talk about.
That'll be interesting, won't it? Yeah. I love the cover of that book. Remind us who's on the cover.
It's Marilyn Monroe tucking into a burger at a drive-thru, symbolic of so many parts of the American dream, which I think if you're an artery in need of a stent is now the American nightmare.
Well, fortunately, we ran out of time for Ryan's nose blow thing.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
It is 4 o'clock. I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive. Thanks, Ree, and thanks, Jane. Here are the headlines. The US Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, says today's America's most intense day of strikes yet in Iran. And the biggest oil exporter in the world, Saudi Arabia, warns of catastrophic consequences for the markets if the war continues. And coming up, what are the calculations being made in Washington and Tehran as Donald Trump describes the conflict as very completed? And we'll be looking at what's going on in the Strait of Hormuz and how the stranded tankers may eventually escape under that threat of Iranian attack.
This is Times Radio.
Here's the news with Eliza Phillips.
Thanks, John. Good afternoon. The war in the Middle East will drive up inflation, the OBR has warned the Treasury. The budget watchdogs told MPs it expects the rate of inflation to end this year closer to 3% if energy prices stay as high as in recent days. Gas and oil prices have soared since the start of the conflict in the Middle East 11 days ago. Well, Professor David Miles from the Office for Budget Responsibility has this forecast about how it could impact prices.
If there's no change in the picture on the prices from now on forward, we estimate that something like 1% higher level of consumer prices in the UK by the end of the year.
The US Defence Secretary says America is planning its most intense day of strikes on Iran. Earlier, President Trump had indicated US objectives in the country are pretty well complete, suggesting the war could end soon. Meanwhile, the Israeli foreign ministers indicated Israel is not seeking an endless war with Iran, but Gideon Saar declined to say when he thinks it will end.
We want to remove for the long term existential threats from Iran to Israel. It is hard to see it with the current regime, with the new Khamenei. The new Khamenei is not less extremist than the previous.
Well, the UK is preparing a second ship for deployment to the Mediterranean. RFA Lime Bay, currently in Gibraltar, is often used for humanitarian and disaster relief missions. The warship HMS Dragon is still being prepared for deployment to Cyprus in the next couple of days. The wrongly convicted sub-postmaster says there will be many more miscarriages of justice if the government goes ahead with plans to curb jury trials. Joe Hamilton has written to the Deputy PM, urging him to rethink the controversial change in the law that would replace jury trials in England and Wales with a single judge. It's in cases where the defendant is likely to face up to 3 years in jail. Well, MPs are due to vote on the bill later, which is aimed at tackling backlogs. Former midwife Donna Ockenden is to chair another investigation into maternity services. The probe was ordered by Health Secretary Wes Streeting over repeated failures at Leeds Teaching NHS Trust. Ms Ockenden says it must be firmly focused on families who have waited far too long for answers.
If we were building a house, you know, we wouldn't put the roof on first. We'd put down strong foundations to make our building safe. And that is very similar with a maternity review. We need to get lots of agreements in place so that I can receive records, so that I can store data.
She also examining maternity failings in Nottingham. A prisoner has been charged with the murder of Ian Huntley. The Soham child killer died on Saturday. 43-year-old Anthony Russell will appear by court by video link tomorrow. And former footballer Joey Barton has been charged with wounding with intent. He's accused of attacking a man near a golf course on Merseyside on Sunday night. The victim is said to be in a stable condition in hospital. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio.
on the free Times Radio app and via your smart speaker.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello, I am John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for your company. Now, breaking news. Donald Trump is thinking about ending the Iran conflict very soon. He called the war very complete after a long phone call with Vladimir Putin. Now, more breaking news. The president is thinking of keeping the war going and raining what he described as fire and fury on Iran if it attacks shipping on the vital sea route through the Straits of Hormuz. His defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, just warned Iran to expect the most intense day of strikes so far. So what does President Trump really mean? What is he thinking? Now, that is never perfectly clear, maybe not even to himself. But with the Wall Street Journal reporting that Trump is being urged by some of his advisers to bring the war to an early close, and with the president fresh from an hour-long telephone conversation with Vladimir Putin, in which the Russian leader reportedly suggested ways to end the war quickly, it is reasonable to suppose that Trump is at least thinking of an early US exit. He also floated the possibility of easing sanctions on Russian oil. So, sounds like it was another warm and friendly conversation between the US and Russian presidents. Apparently, despite the news that Russia is providing actionable intelligence for Iranian attacks on US military targets. Well, let's talk then about the latest turn, the possible turn in thinking in President Trump's White House, and what it may mean for the war, and where the end of the war in Iran may leave that country and its people and the stability of the Middle East. Reading Trump's thinking, it's a game that any number can play. I wonder what you think. Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times or a tweet to @TimesRadio. First, though, let us check in with Karin von Hippel, the former Director General of the Royal United Services Institute. Hello to you, Karin.
Good morning, or good afternoon, I guess. Yes, I hope you're not expecting me to journey into Trump's brain. I'm not sure I'll be very successful.
No, there are limits to the sort of things I might demand, Karin, but I'm always interested in your thoughts. Also, as a former senior official in the US State Department. What do you think, if I can ask you and put it this way, what do you think about Trump contemplating the war ending very soon? This is, of course, after Trump's been on the phone for an hour with Vladimir Putin, who was, of course, an open friend and ally to Iran. Thing is, Karin, that, well, Putin has a way of influencing Trump's thinking, doesn't he?
Well, it seems that the last person he speaks to often has a way of influencing his thinking. I mean, I think the advantage of having very shifting objectives about why the U.S. is at war, the Atlantic Monthly magazine in the U.S. came up with a very good list of 10 excuses he's come up with over 10 days. So if you have all sorts of different reasons, it makes it a lot easier to declare success, because that's, you know, he can basically say, yes, I've achieved all of my goals that I set out.
Yeah, and which I suppose could happen at, well, almost any time. President Trump, when he last spoke, he didn't mention Russia, did he, as a beneficiary of possibly easing oil sanctions. This is for the stated purpose of relieving pressure in the energy market. But that is the presumption, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, Russia is certainly gaining already because oil prices have gone up. Countries like India have been granted a 30-day window to keep buying Russian oil. So I don't think the Russians would be complaining. On the